Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, September the 11th, 2014. This is Michael Norris, along with Bobby Simmons, Jerry Oates, and Jay West. We welcome you to our show. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm doing fine, guys.
Glad to be here.
I'm doing good. I was a little disappointed in this movie I watched today.
Uh-oh.
You're doing
what? I was a little disappointed in this movie I watched today.
Yeah, which one was that?
Well, it was the remake of Jerry Maguire, and it wasn't what I was expecting.
It caught me off guard, too, so I just saw it a few minutes ago.
Now
I know what Scott Till thinks of me. I guess that means I won't get a book.
Well, I think that they're going to run that in a double feature with the Michael Norris, Toby Tyler Runs Away and Joins the Circus from movie that they did a couple of years ago.
It's going to be a sellout.
Was this on Facebook, Bobby?
No, it better not be on Facebook.
It's not yet. It's not on Facebook. I think he sent it to your email.
Okay.
If he did, if it's not there, I'll send it to you tomorrow.
Okay.
Just send it to everybody, Bobby.
We can just post it. You know, I mean, I thought it got it.
I'm not sure Scott's got my email. I know it. You know, I'm on Facebook, but I.
I'll make sure you see it.
Thank you.
Inside joke, but it's I thought it was good.
Okay.
I think that ought to be the next T-shirt. The Renegade T-shirt. Jerry, I don't know if you've ever seen it or not, but Scott made up one. He's put it on a shirt. Oh no, he didn't. He didn't put this on a shirt. He sent them out as Christmas cards one year. It's a body of a 85-year-old man wearing polka dot or heart-shaped figures on a pair of boxer shorts, a wife beater tank top T-shirt, and Ole Anderson's face stuck on it.
Oh my God!
He sent that. I had done a funeral for a close friend of mine that day, and I got home and I was really down in the dumps, and I went to my mailbox, and here's this envelope addressed to me, and it had a Richmond, Virginia postmark on it, and I thought, who in the world? And the only person I could think of in Richmond was Dick, you know, and I thought, well, why would Dick be sending me, you know? I opened that thing up, and it was that picture of Ole, and it said Merry Christmas on it. It was the funniest thing. I just sat in my driveway and laughed till I cried. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And come to find out later on what he did, he sent out a whole bunch of them. But what he did when he swapped trucks, you know, Scott drives for UPS, and he drives, I think, to Cincinnati or somewhere north of Nashville every night. He meets a guy coming from the other direction. They swap trailers and then go back to their home bases. Scott gave the letters to this guy to mail them from somewhere where it wouldn't be a Nashville postmark. So nobody really knew who did it for a long time. He never owned
well,
that
I gotta
until
ask
later
you
on.
One question. I got to ask you one question. Did
yes.
Ole Anderson ever see it?
Yes, he did. He liked it. He laughed about it.
Well, what he has done on a T-shirt, he's taken a picture of Ole, you know, with that frown on his face, and he's got like 15 or 20 of that same little picture in a square on the shirt, and it says the many moods of Ole Anderson under each picture. One says happy, one says grumpy, one says, you know, depressed or whatever, but it's all the same picture.
Same picture, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Jay, you want to do the word from our sponsor real quick before we jump off into the show?
I sure would like to, since Bobby was praising my abilities there before
he
we
was.
Went on the air.
Yeah.
Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/GWHradio. Back to you, Mike.
All right. Well, I kind of come at this subject I wanted to talk about tonight in a roundabout way. I was watching some DVD of some stuff out of Knoxville from 79, 80 or something like that that James had sent me. And there was a guy on there, and the minute I saw him, I naturally recognized him, but I wondered, whatever became of him? He was one of their top baby faces at the time. He and he held the tag title, got a push. You know, he was, did great interviews, fantastic worker in the ring, but he was only around, you know, a handful of years and worked, besides Knoxville, he worked for Watts. Watts put a title on him, and then he worked in Florida, and then he just dropped off the face of the earth, and this guy by the name of Don Diamond. And so I thought, well, that'd be a pretty good subject for the show. Guys who were, you know, had all the talent in the world, got pushes, you know, they were on their way up, and then just for whatever reason, they just disappeared out of, you know, into thin air.
Wasn't the other side of that coin, guys that got pushes that shouldn't have?
Oh yeah, that I'm sure we'll get into that hot and heavy and beat everybody in the territory when we get ready.
Well,
to
I was talking to Bo James on the way home. He called me. And he asked me what we were going to talk about, and I told him, and I brought that part of it up, and he threw the name at me just right off the top of his head, Tex McKenzie. So there's one that I don't understand.
Well, you know, and not to get ahead of ourselves, but Tex, at least Tex had a personality, and he had charisma.
Yeah.
And he drew off of that, and... You know, he was not a great worker by any means, but I guess it's just his personality and charisma drew people to him. But do any of you guys remember Don Diamond?
Yes, I do. As you said briefly, I introduced him on TV a couple of times.
So he did work here in Georgia?
Yes, he did just a guy, very prelim, but he was, when Gordon would talk about him, he would say he came from Florida.
Yeah, I think he was from Tampa or down that way somewhere.
I don't think I ever, I could be mistaken, but I don't think I ever introduced him in any of the arenas. You know, I primarily worked at Atlanta Marriott and Griffin,
right.
I don't think I ever did, but yes, and when he came in, during that brief time, and this is when the first time I worked TV, which was 74, a couple other guys, I believe, that were, you know, young like him came in with him. And so he was. That was another thing that kept him from being distinguishable, was that there were a couple of them, like when all the AWA guys came in at one time, you know.
Well, then in 74, wasn't that about the time that Skip Young and... there was a couple of others that were down that way from Florida that came up here. I know Steamboat was probably, as Richard Blood was probably here at that time.
Right. Yeah. But and, Steamboat, even as Richard Blood, was a little further up the scale.
Right.
But yeah, I do remember the guy's name. And you know, he was young, and he seemed to have the you know, the basics, and you know, would have been a capable guy, and you know, I kind of thought that maybe he changed his name and became somebody else, a la Richard Blood, later on down the line.
No.
Well, let me throw one thing in there. Steamboat never worked here as Richard Blood.
No, Richard Blood did.
It was Tito Santana.
Santana. That's correct.
Yeah, he was Richard Blood.
Yes.
The real Richard Blood, Please Stand Up, always worked as Steamboat.
Correct. Yeah, I was going basically by the name, but yes, I'm sure that had to be confusing on tax forms and things of that nature.
Taxes? What's that?
Yeah, I can remember some of that discussion also, people pulling out there. Yes, yes. That's a whole other subject, but I can remember on TV one morning when there was a discussion about, I don't know how to get in touch with that guy. I don't even know what his real name is, you know, and that sort of thing. But, yeah, tax, you know, that was another can of worms in a lot of businesses. In the music business, I had to get guys because when I dealt with the band, my musicians were independent contractors, and they carried their own music. They carried their own instruments. And they made their own way to and from. As Bobby, I'm sure what I'm telling you here sounds reminiscent of how you can qualify somebody as an independent contractor. But they had to sign their payoff sheet, the whole business, and that's the way I kept myself straight, because I did get, you know, during the years I had my band, I had my own EIN number. And I had to keep that straight, because occasionally I'd get a form saying that I'd made all this money, and in fact I hadn't made all this money. It had been payoffs to the musicians.
Another name that came to mind, it was the second name that I first thought, was Brian St. John. St. John worked in Mobile. He worked here, I know, because
yep.
He was here when I used to come over here, and got a good push down in Florida. He and Stan Lane were the Florida Tag Team Champions. They're, again, another good guy, great ring worker, good on the microphone, and just, you know, walked away. I don't know whether they just got, between the two of them, they just got disenchanted with the business or found out it was a work and didn't like it or what the deal was. But, those two guys that I thought would have been around for a long time, and both of them just disappeared.
The last time I saw him was in Charlotte. Never heard from him again. He was a fantastic artist, though.
Really?
Yes, he was. Yeah, well, you know,
he was a good guy.
His sister lasted longer than he did.
Yeah. You know, we lost her last year.
Yeah.
Was it this year?
Might have been... either late last year or early this year.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an element of it, is that some guys just have other talents that they find out it's easier, or, you know, something that gives them the opportunity to work in that field, and they decide, you know, what's going to be the best opportunity to put the beans on the plate, and so they decide to take a different road, you know.
You know, Brian, you know, and I think you got a good point there, Jay, because, you know, guys, we talk about this a lot, but you either had to love, you know, this was not a business you got into just because you wanted to be in a business. You either loved this or you didn't. And I think some guys, when they found out that you know, especially if they sit home and they watch TV and they see the guy come on TV and he goes, man, I'm just tickled to death to be here in Davenport, Iowa on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for this live TV, and they don't know that they just drove 600 miles or however far it is from Kansas City to get to Iowa to TV.
Hmm.
They don't see the backside of it.
Right.
And, you know, the preliminary guys, you know, they're going to make preliminary money, whatever that is, whatever. I know here the guarantee was $65, but, you know, you work five nights for $65 and that's all you make. That's $25,
and that's you know, before Uncle Sam gets his share.
That's before Uncle Sam. That's if and some of them, you know, we laugh about. Some of them never filed taxes in their life.
Right.
I can name names on some. They were so afraid the IRS was going to catch up with them. But anyway, they didn't pay taxes. But you got the expense. You got to keep a car running. I mean, there was
right.
Some of those guys. I think that you kind of hit it. They became disillusioned. And just didn't have the witherall to stay with it. I mean, I was, you know, and some of them didn't grow up fans. Some of them backed into the business, you know. They just, whereas you take Jerry and myself and Michael, you know, we were diehard fans. Man, it was
yes.
All I ever wanted to do. And you know.
Well, that was me with the broadcasting business, you know. That's what I wanted to do as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, there you go. I mean, if that's all you ever want to do and you get in it, man, I was so blessed and so thrilled to be in the wrestling business, man. They could have sent me to $10 too, and I'd have said, how you get there?
Right. And then there's another thing. Once you spend so, you know, you put so much of your time, energy, and effort into it, this is sad to say, but it's hard to back out because you're entrenched. You know, it's there's always two sides to the coin, and it's fortunate that you do love the business so much because there are times when you said, "Man, did I make a mistake?" No, but I love this, so let's see what else is going to happen. Let me mention a name here because I introduced him a lot and I know he's still around, but because of his size, he was certainly just a guy that mostly worked TV here in Atlanta, and that was Mike Jackson. Mike, I assume that he got, am I right, a bigger push in Alabama?
No,
he did not.
No, the biggest push Mike ever got was working for Gulas. But mainly in Birmingham, because he was from Birmingham, and Mike spent most of his early career teamed with another guy from Birmingham by the name of Tony Ledoux, and they were called the Birmingham Boys. And they, you know, they were like Rocket Monroe and Riverdale. You couldn't beat them in Birmingham.
Right.
And then they got a little bit of a push working for Bill Golden. But most of the time, I mean, they were, you know, mid-card or so.
Right.
But as far as the singles go, no. Mike, you know, except for you know, outlaws around Atlanta that he provided all the talent to, just like he's still doing today.
Right.
That was the only way he ever worked on top. I mean, he was a good worker. I'm not going to take it away from him. But because of his size,
right,
it just wasn't believable.
He was just too little. I mean, he was, you know.
Yeah.
He
could do anything in the world you needed him to do, but he was not believable.
The biggest push he ever got, because I used him, was pushing that gimmick table toward the exits after the match was over, still trying to sell gimmicks.
Yep.
That used to make me so mad. I'd see him doing that. He was there just for that. But he was too little. I mean, you know, it's like, these shows you go to now, and I hadn't been to one in I don't know how long, years and years. The people in the stands, in the audience, look better than the guys in the ring because nobody knows what they look like. They all got on T-shirts and blue jeans. They don't look like athletes. I mean, that's another story. But there was just 100 guys. I mean, and the sad part about it, he could work.
Oh, yeah. I always thought he was a good flyer, you know, and he
very good, yeah.
And I assume he took direction very well because he could make other guys look real good.
Yeah, he was. But you have to remember, like I said, the biggest pushes he got was in territories where they use small guys.
Right.
I mean, the biggest guy in Gulas' territory was probably, you know, Lawler, and he weighed maybe all of 220 pounds.
Right. Yeah, that was a circuit where small guys did a lot of work.
Exactly, and Mobile was the same way. Mobile used the biggest guy we ever had, and Mobile was Rip Tyler, and he was, you know, I mean, we had Grizzly Smith, and we had Big Bad John and guys like that passed through, but,
right,
you know, for the every, you know, the day-in, day-out regulars, Rip Tyler was the biggest we had, and he was only 250 pounds.
Well,
you had guys like Dick Dunn, who was, you know, billed at 225, but if he weighed 200, it would have been a miracle.
Right. I always wondered why Jackson never tried to work, and maybe he did in Mexico. You know,
he did come to Mobile. In fact, he was a Gulf Coast champion for 25 minutes.
Right.
When Duke Myers was there, and he was a Gulf Coast champion, he did a gimmick thing. He would, on Saturday night, or Saturday morning television, he would give away the Gulf Coast title to some prelim or job guy and say, "I'm giving you the title. And I challenge you to a match in Mobile on Tuesday night for the title," and then he'd win it back. You know, they did that. They did that 5 or 6 weeks in a row, and everybody was knowing, you know, well, you know, he's gonna beat this guy, and
right.
He finally, you know, lost it to Ken Lucas. Not that Ken Lucas was, you know, a prelim guy or anything, but it's just that's just how the way they worked that angle.
Right.
Mike Jackson happened to be one of them. So I'm sure they took. I'm sure the Fields took the belt away from him when he left the TV studio, or he did not made the match in Mobile and still had that belt today.
He'd be on the gimmick table.
Yeah.
Well, I know that Gordon always touted him as Jackson as having a master's degree.
The Alabama Junior Heavyweight title. Let me tell you a little bit of history about that belt. It was Jackson's own personal belt. Now, how he ended up with it, I don't know. Because the first time I ever saw that belt, Rip Tyler had it, and they were using it when Watts left Leroy McGuirk and came to Florida and Georgia with the Reggie Parks made North American belt, same one Jerry had. They brought Rip Tyler into Oklahoma as the booker. Well, they needed a North American. They were still recognizing the title there. They just didn't have a belt. So somehow or another, they ended up with this belt, and what the belt actually says is AWA Junior Heavyweight Champion on it. That's what the belt reads. Now, I don't know if the AWA ever had a Junior Heavyweight Champion or whatever, but anyway, Rip used it as the North American belt. And then he had it, Tank Patton had it, a couple other guys had it. But then when he left, Rip left and came back to Mobile, he brought it with him. And that was the last I saw of it until I started working with Jackson, and lo and behold, he's got it. Now, I have no clue where he got it from. As far as I know, Ted Allen may have gotten it from somewhere and given it to him, sold it to him. Ted wouldn't
right.
give it to me.
He wouldn't have any trouble getting one made today. But the AWA had, I believe it was a light heavyweight championship.
But that was in the 80s.
Yes, yes.
But this belt was Rip was out in Oklahoma in 74, so it was around that same time. 72, 74, whenever it was that Watts left there and came here, so about 72, I guess. But that's I've got pictures of Rip with the belt and Tank Patton with it, and from they were taken in Oklahoma by little Al Vavasour. But that's the very exact same belt that Jackson had as the Alabama Junior Heavyweight Champion. And what he used to do, he only defended it in the little outlaw groups that he worked for all over around Birmingham and central Alabama. And the only guy I ever knew that beat him for it was another guy that used to come over here and do jobs and did jobs in Mobile and everything. It was a guy named Ronnie Horn. I don't know if you guys know that name, but... I think Jackson probably trained him, but anyway, he would he and Ronnie swapped the title belt a couple of times. But what he would do is Jackson would have it with him, give it to him in the dressing room, you know, let him wear it out to the ring, and if he happened to keep it, Jackson took it away from him when they got back to the dressing room and left with it. So, but as far as I know, that was the only person I wrestled him for it a couple of times, but. Of course, I was, he wasn't going to let me win it. He won it. He found out I had this belt that Bobby's now got in his showcase, that Gulf Coast Tag Team belt, and he tried every way he could to get that belt off of me, let him use it, and I said, no, I don't think so. But to answer your question, yeah, he was better known as a tag team wrestler, him and Tony Ledoux, and they were the Birmingham boys, in the mid-70s, they got quite a push. In fact, he was still in 1980, 81, whenever it was I was up there and working with him. He was still selling pictures of him and Tony Ledoux, and people, we'd sit there at ringside because he did the house announcing for Fuller in Birmingham at the Powell Auditorium. And, you know, we'd sit there, and there'd be at least a half a dozen people every Monday night come up and ask him whatever happened to Tony Ledoux, and was him and Tony Ledoux going to get back together? So they had a big following. And Gulas was smart enough to know, since they were hometown boys,
mm-hmm.
you know, usually a hometown guy doesn't get a push, you know, in his hometown, but Gulas was smart enough to note that, you know, they had a could gain a following, and they did, evidently, because they were... I don't think they ever lost a match in Birmingham.
Jerry, you know, you're a pretty good-sized guy, but Ted was a little smaller. Did you ever get the impression that he felt like if he'd been a little bit bigger guy, I think he did great in the business, but that held him back a little bit?
Mm,
maybe, you know, sometimes they would ask him, is he the tall one or the short one, if I wasn't around, and that didn't go over so good. But,
I love it.
But you know, he was 6 feet, but I think, maybe. But that, in his mind, I don't know. You know, he didn't venture out like I did. I don't know why. He just didn't. I wanted to go, you know, a lot of different places.
Well, that was the name of the game at the time, you know. That's
yep.
Ted carried a little weight, though. Ted weighed what, 220, 225?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ted was thick.
That's thick. That's a good word. He was not. Mike Jackson is just tiny.
Yes.
You know, but Ted, even Ted was about 6 foot. That's close. You know, we until my knees started bending a little. I was 6'2", so yeah, we were about the same height, pretty close. So, you know, it was I never thought of Ted as being that small.
No. We just had different physiques.
You guys were built standing next to each other. Of course, you were, I mean, that's just the way it was. But, you know, like your promo pictures that you guys did were I can't remember if you was on top or bottom. One of you'd sit on the top rope, one sat on the middle rope or the bottom rope. You know, those kind of pictures, you know, you guys were great tag team publicity shots. And even the shots of you guys in the ring side by side, you had tag teams where one guy was taller than the other guy all the time. That was never an issue, I don't think.
No, you know. But he, I never thought of him as little. He well, like Dickie wasn't a tall guy.
True.
No, he wasn't.
No.
At all.
Well, in fact, if you think about it, Jerry, when you started in the early 70s, somebody your height, what were you, 6'4", 6'3", 6'4"?
3.
That was not an everyday thing. I mean, the only ones around, you know, guys like Ernie Ladd, Ron Fuller, you know, Jimmy Golden and Robert Fuller, all, you know, 6'5 or better. You know, and I was 6'5", but I only weighed about, 205 pounds at the time. So,
but nearly everybody I worked with, I was taller than, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They you were a giant when you were in Mobile. Ken Lucas was what, 5'8", 5'9"? Kelly, 5'10", 5'11"?
Yeah.
You know, Eddie Sullivan, 5'7"? You know, you stood head and shoulders above all of them. And it's just there wasn't a lot of tall guys that came through. And when they were, you know, they made it out. You know, they that was part of their publicity about how tall they were. Of course, they always added 2 or 3 inches to it. I mean, they always built Tiny Frazier as being 7'2", and he might have been 6'8", maybe.
Oh, well, before we go, and I don't know if anybody saw this, and I saw this on Facebook about Oxford's in real bad shape.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's what I saw.
I had not been able to confirm it one way or the other. I heard he was in hospice care.
I saw something on that yesterday, and that he was not good.
Well, if anybody can beat him, be him, because if old Mr. Death comes after him, well, Ox will step on his foot and he'll run the other way.
As far as the subject goes, and I don't mean to talk about somebody that's, you know, may not be with us much longer, he was one. He couldn't work a lick.
Not a bit, and would kill you.
But he was a rugged looking, and he could talk.
But yeah, back then, exactly. He got by on the looks and the charisma.
And the talk.
He built something of a reputation off of that heart punch because of unfortunate circumstances of some people him being in the ring with that passed away shortly after a match with him.
I know, but that could have been any of us that worked with him.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
You ever work with him.
that I understand, but it helped build his reputation. By that
looked at him as a killer.
Yeah.
I mean, that,
yes.
You know, and that was, you know, the thing. To this day, you know, he hit me harder than any human being has ever hit me in my life. I mean, he just And he didn't mean to. He was just clumsy.
I mean, it's just.
Well, there again, you're talking about guys like that. We mentioned Tex McKenzie earlier. And Jerry's favorite wrestler, Moose Cholak, was another one. And
The Moose.
But you have to think, back in those days when these guys were popular, a guy 6 foot seven, 6 foot eight, or whatever, that or 350 or so weight wise was such an anomaly. If you weren't Haystack Calhoun, that they got over by that because people can't, and look at. I'm sure I never saw him work, but I'm quite sure Happy Humphrey couldn't work a lick, but he drew crowds.
Well, that was a comparison thing. If you compared him to the McGuire twins, he was probably pretty fast.
Yeah. he was like the Roadrunner versus Wile E. Coyote that way. But another one that got a push was one version of the world champion. And, of course, I didn't see him till late in his career. And he did not have a physique. Wasn't all that great a talker that I ever saw, and that's Stan Stasiak. But he had a long, successful career.
Well, I think Stasiak had that physique and that look of the guys during that time that worked in the WWF. WWWF. A lot of those guys were big. They were very slow. But they had the particular look that was successful or wanted in the Northeast at that time. It's certainly a different look that they're going for now.
I hear what you're saying, but Stasiak had big runs here in Georgia. He had big runs in the Pacific Northwest. Don Owen loved him. And in Hawaii and in Texas,
Well, he got – another thing was he got coverage. He got – and sometimes when fans are – see that stuff in those magazines, we've already talked about it. You come in with that reputation, and people have a tendency to take you for that reputation.
I think those magazines help tremendously. I mean, that's my personal belief.
I agree totally. I mean, look at what a big star Mill Maskers became based off of his magazine coverage.
There's another guy.
I've heard so many mixed things. Jack Briscoe loved working with him. Thought he was great. Dick Beyer liked working with him. Of course, those guys had the capabilities to make him work and make him sell if they decided to.
Here's the thing about it. If you ever sit and watch one of his matches, I don't care who he's working with, it's ask Harley Race about him. He'll tell you. But Ted liked working with some guys that I didn't, and vice versa, he couldn't, he did that mess, that Mexican style, Mexico style, and, that wasn't going to get it.
In Georgia, the worst match I ever refereed in my life was him against the Missouri Mauler.
Ooh.
And
I'm
going to
tell you
something.
The reason it was so bad is Larry, Larry had that rough style, but this guy, everything he does is a pose.
Yep, right.
He looked good getting off the bus. When he took that robe off, people would gasp. He had a little bitty waist and big broad shoulders, but everything he did was a pose. He would climb up on the top rope to do that cross body block and would stand up there and pose, and it made the other guy look stupid standing there waiting on him to come off on him.
He didn't care about
that.
I
was never, ever, ever impressed with him.
No. But here again, it's like Jay said earlier, all that publicity he got in those magazines. But he was a guy you could bring in once a year. You couldn't do nothing with him.
By Mexican standards, he was a big guy, if you compared him to a lot of the guys that worked there. And when you saw those pictures of him, he looked like a big guy when you would see him in those matches. And you looked at his physique, like Bobby said, and you said, holy cow. And Bill Apter talked about how he loved to have him on the cover because of those great-looking masks he had. You put all that together, And as Jerry was saying, a couple of times a year, you bring somebody like, I mean, people are, I mean, I remember when the, what was it, the IWA was here for a while. I mean, people came to those matches, Ihorn's matches here, because they wanted to see Mil Máscaras. And, you know, he was, no way he was going to not win the match. He always was in the last match, and he was billed as their world champion. But, you know, once again, you were seeing guys that, a guy that you probably never would have seen otherwise. And, you know, that's what fans paid to see. And they wanted to see him win, and he did win, obviously.
Well, backing up just a step or two, talking about guys that had all the tools and were pretty much on their way or whatever, and either walked away from the business or disappeared or whatever. But this is a name that Charlie Smith brought up that we were talking about big guys who could work last week. One that we failed to mention was Dr. X, Doug Scoggins. Or for those that knew him well, Kissy. Doug, I never got a chance to see him work. He came through Mobile about the time that he was here and worked a handful of matches, you know, mainly in Dothan, Panama City, and places like that where, you know, he was closer to Georgia. But from everybody I've heard talk about him, for a guy his size, and like I said, I never saw him, but just seeing pictures of him, I would guess Kissy was what, Bobby, 6'2", 6'3", 320 pounds or so?
Yeah, at least. He was a protege of Tom Ernesto, could do anything he could. Anything he wanted to. He could fly. He could do whatever he wanted to do. He's a big guy. But he just, you know, there again, he's getting a push. The first week he made $1,000, he got killed that Monday.
I remember when
he was supposed to go to New York.
Do what?
He was supposed to go to New York.
Well, he was supposed to go to. He was going to Japan too.
I remember when Tom mentioned his death on television, and you know that was a very difficult thing to do because you had to, you know, break the kayfabe kind of just a little bit to do it because he was a heel, and at that time it was hard for people to feel, you know, you didn't want them to feel sympathy for a heel, but you could tell how difficult that was for Tom Ernesto, you know, to discuss his death, and because there was a lot of sincerity there when he discussed it. I remember that to this day.
I was only about 16 when this happened. I drove to Elberton to his funeral. That's where he was from. He was originally from, Elberton, Georgia. Him and Wayne Cowan were roommates. And just to show you how it works, you know, or how Rocket was going to Augusta that Monday night, and he didn't want to ride by himself, so he had picked me up after school, and I was at his apartment. I was going to ride with him. And Juan Caruso lived next door to Rocket in the apartments there, and Wayne Cowan called and wanted to know if he could ride to Augusta. So it was me and Rocket and Wayne Cowan. I'm in the back seat, 14-year-old kid, you know. You have to leave for Augusta from Atlanta at 4:30. You had to leave for Valdosta at 3:30. And Kissy did not get to Caruso's apartment to pick him up until about 4:45, maybe 4:50. We were still there, maybe closer to 4:30. But he pulled up because we spoke to him as him and Caruso got in the car, and they said he was running over 100 mile an hour when he hit that crane on the side of the road there in Perry. They assume he went to sleep. Caruso was asleep in the car. He was asleep over against the window, and Kissy evidently went to sleep. And when Caruso woke up, it was not a good sight. He was never the same again. But, that was a tough time around here. And you talk about breaking kayfabe. It's funny how these things come in your head and you remember them. It might have been Griffin. I can't remember. We were somewhere. It must have been because that was about the only place I worked other than Atlanta at the time. I was just tearing tickets and doing stuff for Charlie Harbin. They announced that he had been killed the Monday before in Griffin on that Saturday night. and the fans started cheering. I'll never forget this.
Yes.
They started cheering, and Dickie Steinborn came out of the dressing room, and he walked down and he got in the ring. And I'll never forget him I can remember, like, I can almost hear it in my head. He told them people, he said, look, I didn't agree with the way he wrestled either. I didn't agree with what he did or how he did or the way he acted, but he was an athlete, and he did what he thought was right, and he gave his all for this business, and he gave his all for you to enjoy his wrestling. And they were doing the 10 bell count is what they were going to do. And I remember, man, I can remember 14 years old standing there squalling. Because that 10 bell count, I mean, and I'm 59 years old, and I can hear it on TV now for somebody I don't know, and I'll sit here and cry. So just, but I can remember, I remember that just like it was yesterday.
I heard the same thing happen in Tampa when they announced that Bobby Shane had been killed. The fans cheered.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's part of the psychology. You can't help but think about some of the wild, bizarre things. I mean, you know, you know that from the marks that hit the ring and try to do things. But the wild things that you know, you would see Shane and these guys do in the ring and whatnot. I can understand why it was difficult for certain fans to separate one from the other. But still,
yeah, and you got to remember this, and you know, and I'm not. The time frame we're talking about here, too, our business was in a totally different era, and we were selling it as real.
Yep.
Yes.
And you know, people were buying it. So, you know, but I just
right.
I can't think of a human being that you could tell me had died, and I would think it was good or cheer about it, but that's just the mentality, I guess, of what we were doing.
Right. Well, Saddam Hussein was one of them that I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
But
even at that, you know, even at that, with that video floating around, you know, I've never watched it. I don't want to see that.
I don't either. I agree with you 100%. I wasn't unhappy that he was no longer with us.
Yeah, know? I mean, I was not. I didn't shed any tears, but yet I didn't cheer either.
I wouldn't want to see the video either. You know, that's not my style.
Yeah.
Well, when we're talking about guys that got pushes that really didn't have the talent to deserve those pushes, most people, you know, point out promoters' kids, and some get lumped in that shouldn't be, but I think the beginning and end of that conversation, or that conversation begins and ends with George Gulas.
Well, you know, that's probably true, and you knew him pretty well, but I got to tell you that for a double-shot guy with no capability on either end as either a worker or an announcer, I got to put David Crockett right there on top.
Well, that's true, too.
He was head of the list. But...
he was the first name on my list.
But the thing about that, and Joe, and I'll never forget, Joe Turner told me about this, that, you know, David was sincere about wanting to do it. You know, he wasn't like Gulas. It wasn't telling Rocket Monroe, Daddy said sell. You know, David was sincere about wanting what he was wanting to do, and he was married to Joe for a while there because Joe worked a lot of matches with him, you know, helping him along. But Joe told me that the old man told him, look, if he gets out of line or tries to take advantage, snatch him. And Joe said it happened one time, and that's all it took. And David apologized to him and everything, and But he was not fond of Jim Crockett Jr. Joe wasn't, because he was always giving David a hard time about wanting to be a wrestler. And Joe said he would tell David, "Oh, you better than that. They're just old wrestlers, you know." And David never felt that way, and he earned Joe's respect just based on that. The fact that, you know, at least he was sincere about it. But there again, he was not believable. He had, what Don Fargo used to say about Dick Dunn, he had those buggy whip arms and was pale as a ghost's butt like Tim Woods, but, you know, he didn't have the talent Tim Woods did.
Well, I only saw pictures of David Finley. You know, I never saw him actually work, but he looked like he was about 14 years old in a pair of trunks.
Yeah.
And I could only judge that based on what I saw him as a on-air talent. And like you said, he was trying to, you know, carry on the family business. And I think probably behind the scenes there was a place for him. but it wasn't as a
In front of a camera. You're
it
right
wasn't
there.
As a commentator on the show. I don't think he did anybody any favors there.
No, not a bit. He oversold, if anything else, you know.
And he just didn't have the chops.
No, but you could put him with Bob Caudle, which they did most of the time, or you know, and Caudle could kind of reel him in and cover up for him. Now, can you see him and Johnny Weaver working together, his commentators together? And there again, Johnny Weaver. You know, I never saw Johnny work, but I hear he was pretty good. But as far as looks, he was like Dick Dunn. Dick Dunn, you can take a look at Dick Dunn and think that guy couldn't work his way out of a paper bag, but he was a whale of a worker. Greg Peterson. Everybody thought Greg Peterson was an old, you know, bar fly because he had that big beer belly. But, boy, he could tie you in a knot in a heartbeat. And but I never saw him work, but I've heard similar comments about Leon Ogle. Jerry, how was he as a worker?
He couldn't work.
I mean,
Johnny
I know
Weaver.
He was a tough guy in real life and everything. He was.
He was. No, Johnny Weaver was a fantastic worker.
Yeah, I was wondering if you worked with him there.
Oh, he's a fantastic worker. He was another promoter's son was Mike Graham.
You know that, and he's one of the ones that get lumped into the. You know, the only reason he made it because he was daddy's boy, and Greg Gagne the same way. And this is just my opinion, but Mike Graham and Greg Gagne were fantastic workers.
I think the problem with both of them, and you know, even though Gagne's son was a string bean. And Mike Graham started out that way, even though he bulked up. But once again, you've got really small guys, and it's really hard in either case to take them seriously as championship contenders.
Exactly. And people just not go
by. Actually, Mike lost weight the longer he was in the business. When he started, he was pretty bulky, but he'd been a power lifter. You know, but everybody's knock on him was he was so short. Well, I don't know.
Right.
He had an amateur background as a you know, 12-year-old, he was beating college students, and this was
so he's a fantastic wrestler, you know.
And was a power lifter, so he had all the only thing was he was short.
He definitely
and
was.
Kevin Sullivan was short. Kevin Sullivan
he was
the world's biggest midget.
Well, Kevin, on the other hand, also had the real ability to sell his, persona.
Yeah.
And he did real well from that standpoint. And, you know, I think as a heel, he was much, much more effective than he ever was as a babyface, and that's how he spent most of his career. But, yeah, he was kind of the exception, I would say, to a really small guy being over to a certain extent.
Well, another one would be Bill Dundee.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Dundee's, you know, I tease him about being the world's biggest midget, but Bill Dundee could work either way. And you'd love him to death or you'd hate him because he could manipulate a crowd better than anybody or, you know, as good as anybody I ever saw. And he used that shortness as a way of being the underdog.
Well, that's another thing you were talking about, Lawler. I mean, Dundee and Lawler worked together so much that, you know, that he made Lawler look like a big guy, you know. But, yeah, they were just kind of like the hometown match, weren't they? I mean, you know,
Pretty much, yeah. But it drew together for year after year after year, like Bobo Brazil and the Sheik.
Sure.
And that's another one whose son probably falls in the George Gulas territory. I don't know if any of you guys ever saw Captain Ed George work, but that was Farhat's son, and they went so far as to create a title for him to have because they knew nobody believed in running a regular title in Detroit. So, but he was not the best in the world either. But
well, I'll tell you, a guy we're talking about, you know, promoter sons or whatever. But this was a manager son that wrestled that was a heck of a wrestler, George Weingroff.
Weingroff, absolutely.
And George was legally blind.
Absolutely.
But he could sure go.
He sure could. He and Randy Poffo were working up there for Angelo when they had that. ICW or whatever their promotion was, but Weingroff was a great worker. But he there again too. He was also an amateur wrestler.
Yeah.
And you know, and people knock Greg Gagne, but you know, Greg Gagne there again, it's because of the guys he was working with, guys like Adrian Adonis and Jesse Ventura and these big, you know, big guys, but you put him in there with a Nick Bockwinkel, who wasn't all that big, or Ray Stevens, and, you know, he fit right in with him, in my opinion, and he was a great worker.
Well, when they teamed him with Jim Brunzell.
There's no doubt.
I'm sorry,
Gary.
Go ahead.
No, that's right. I mean, if you watch him, I mean, he could work. I mean, he could.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Very good worker. He's just little. That's all. I don't know what a man.
They teamed him with Jim Brunzell, and that kind of hid. You know, they would do the double team stuff as the, you know, that kind of hid some of the. But they brought him in. They came down here to work for a while, and you know, Georgia was a wrestling territory, but most of the guys here were big. And even if they weren't tall, they were thick, as Mike says, you know. And of course, back in the day we're talking about too, wrestling was a host of characters, not necessarily gimmick characters, but just different people. They had different sizes, different, you know. Guy out of Tennessee, Tony Russo.
Yep.
You know, 5 foot tall, but he was 6 foot around in the chest, had a big barrel chest. Oscar Verdoux, Crusher Verdoux, man. He wasn't very tall, but, God, he had that great big barrel chest, and he was hard as a rock. But there's another name that got a big push that couldn't do a whole heck of a lot.
Well, he spent a lot of time in the Northeast. Time I saw him was on, you know, the Pittsburgh show. And so, to me, that was a reason that I saw – you know, credibility in All South bringing him in. I wanted to see the guy at least, you know, live one time. And I did, probably a couple more than once, but I wouldn't have paid any attention to him had I not seen him from, you know, working in the Northeast and on a few covers of magazines.
Yeah, nice guy, but he just, you know, I mean, because of his size and his limited mobility, because he was so bulked up, he couldn't move.
Right. And
well,
they pushed that chest of
his. Go ahead, Jerry.
I was just going to say they, you know, they pushed that his chest, his big chest that Verdoux had, you know, and he would come out there puffed up like that, and he'd say a few words, but you know, and that wasn't impressive. But then I always put him in a, you know, on TV in a match with a guy that was, you know, going to go out pretty quick, and they'd do a few moves, and you could protect somebody like him when they didn't, you know, when they didn't go very long.
Well, you know, here again, we're talking about these guys, you know, and I'm not saying this now because we know better, but you take, you know, the Mongols, you know, Newton Tatry and the first guy was
Nikolai
Volkov. You know, those guys didn't know the stomp and kick and chop meat. They didn't do anything else. And then when Bill Eaton came in, you know, Bill came in after Nikolai left. That's all Bill did. You know, we didn't know, I mean... We know now what Bill Eady was capable of, but at the time, I mean, you know, when I met Bill Eady, I was like 17 years old, and you know, I didn't, other than big guys, I didn't see a lot in them.
Well, thing about that was that worked into their gimmick.
That's what I'm saying. That was what it was.
Well, Archie Goldie as a stomper was the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I saw the Mongols on TV from Pittsburgh, first time they were there. I mean, they were depicted as unbeatable, and of course they put them there on TV against guys that were, you know, would go out very quickly once again. But even in their first matches against guys that were hometown guys that generally got a little bit of push, I mean, they'd take care of them in just a few seconds. So you know, they built them up that way, and they developed that reputation. And I guess, you know, that's how you did it at the time. But people bought it, and that's what they were supposed to do.
Talking about guys who had talent that really didn't get the push that deserved it, and Dale Veazey, to me, why in the world he didn't go further in the business? I mean, he had his pushes once he, you know, became the Alaskan Hunter, he and Bob Brown, and then when he was with Dwayne Brunch as the State Patrol. But Dale, to me, had all the looks and everything. He was a decent-sized guy. He was thick, and
he
never heard him. Was
very
short.
Little. I trained him.
Yeah, I know.
He
you did.
I trained him. But he was just little. I mean, he was a short guy. He really was. He couldn't have been no more than 5'8".
Yeah, I guess
and that's short.
It depends on where they worked, I guess, because You know, there again, I grew up watching guys that weren't very big, and that was the last thing that ever. They were never built up as being monsters, you know. But yeah, I guess you're right about Dale, because he used to do TV same time I was doing.
He could work now. I don't think he could.
He was a great worker. Gerald Finley was another one there again. The size, you know. Gerald, I've got somewhere around here, I've got a videotape of Gerald working with Bob Backlund, and it's a good competitive match.
Right.
But Gerald was maybe 5'3", 5'4", but was a whale of a worker.
That's another guy that disappeared. Nobody knows what happens to him.
Gerald Finley.
Gerald Finley.
Where was he from, Bobby? South Carolina?
Atlanta. Yeah.
Atlanta?
Yeah, I think... It's been several years ago, but Levi said he ran into him. It stopped at a convenience store, and Gerald walked up behind him, was in the store. And that's the last I heard about him, but he's around, still around here, I guess.
Well, you were talking about the Mongols in Pittsburgh, Jay. After Nikolai left and Bill Eadie came in, Bill, I probably told this, I don't know, but Bill said that his introduction to the wrestling business, they worked a 2 out of 3 fall match on TV there in Pittsburgh, and he said they went to the dressing room between falls because they would do interviews.
Right.
And he said they were out there for the first match, and he said they were beating on some guy, and some guy on the front row had a massive heart attack and fell out of his chair on the floor.
Oh, wow.
And he said, of course, they ended the fall and they left. Well, they come back and told him the dressing room, it's going to be a few minutes, said the guy died.
Oh.
So they hauled the guy out, you know, the guy literally had a heart attack and died watching their match. So they go back out for the second fall, and Bill said the thing that shocked him was the guy's family's all still sitting in the front row. None of them left. And he said after the match was over, he asked somebody about it, and the guy said they made the comment and said, well, he's dead. Ain't nothing we can do. We want to see who wins the matches.
Oh, man.
So he said that was his introduction to Pittsburgh wrestling.
Oh, wow. Reminds me of the story of the Dick Cavett show, where he had this guy that was close to 100 years old on his show with several others. You know, he would have several people out on the panel, and the guy was talking about how he had lived as long as he had. They went to commercial, and they came back, and they were talking among, you know, the other people there on the panel, and all of a sudden they asked this guy something, and he didn't respond. They thought he was sleeping, and he had passed away. Obviously, that show didn't make air, but... a guy that Bobby mentioned a couple of weeks ago, and I don't want to give the impression that he didn't main event, because he did, but I always, you know, and I know he had a back injury in the late 70s, but I always thought Tommy Siegler had a lot more ability than he ever got credit for and should have been much more of a major contender for the world title than he was.
I agree with that. Yeah, Tommy was a whale of work and still in great shape.
He looks the same today as he did then.
Except his hair's white.
Yep, he's just white-headed now, but he looks the same.
He's almost as good a shape for his age as Jerry Oates is.
Yes, sir. He's close.
Well, you know,
probably take the two of them and make a main event anywhere in the world.
I was thinking about him as far as the NWA was concerned when they looked for who they're going to, you know, put the belt on. He didn't have the family background in the business and the collegiate, I don't believe, titles that they kind of look for and things like that. But I always thought he was very solid, both in his interviews and in his matches. And he was something that I would think of for the NWA champion, even though he wasn't as smooth as, say, Briscoe or as believable as Funk, but, you know, he was very believable in the ring. What he did, it appeared to be legit.
That's very true. He was a whale of a worker. I think he ended up spending more time in the Carolinas because he was from that up there and still lives there.
Right.
Lives in Anderson.
Anderson, yeah.
He retired from the, not the sheriff's department, but the... He had something to do with parks and recreation up there, but he was a deputy, but he did something with them.
Some of those guys get that kind of business just off of their fame, you know. I'm kidding here. I was ribbing Jerry a little bit about what he does, but
we're sitting here talking about guys like that, and we sit here and talk to him every week. But Jerry Oates should have gone further in the business than he did. And I'm being absolutely serious. Jerry had all the skills. He had
you know
looks.
What happened?
He could talk.
You know what happened to me? I got off the road too soon. Full time got off the road
yeah.
too soon.
But
I
you
was,
were also smart, too, Jerry, because you had something to fall
I
back
was,
on.
I was. And I really don't regret it. I started in 70, and I come off the road full time in 79. So those 9 years I've been on the road. And we come home, and I don't regret any of it because I did super well. I did better than the guys that started when I did a lot better than they did financially. You know, I had a little strip shopping center. I had a building paid for. I had a business. But I did so much wrestling after I come home. You know, I was doing something every week somewhere. But full time, nah. And, you know, to have gone to New York where I could have fit in with that crowd and that, I don't know. Maybe the money would have changed how I thought. But Gordon Solie told me one time when he was doing something up there with Turner when he was he doing something when he was WCW?
Yeah, every once in a while.
Every once in a while he was in and out, yeah.
He had to come to Columbus to see Dr. Andrews, and I picked him up at the airport. And he told me, he says, I know you. He said, I've known you since you started. You know, he was there in Florida when I started. He said, you would go up there to that, wherever they were doing the TV. He said, you'd sit there in that dressing room about 10 minutes, and you'd fold up your bag. He said, you'd go home. He said, you'd walk out.
Right.
He said, you couldn't take it. I said, I'm sure. And, you know, when Watts was running it, I never called and asked him to use me or I just. It, really and truly, by the time I got in it, and I started in March of 1970, and it wasn't long after that, I remember hearing Dickie and Buddy Colt. We were coming from Augusta one night, and they were talking about, they said, one day, I'll never forget this, it was coming from Augusta, coming to Savannah, and they said, one day, it'll be where you like wrestling Miami one night, San Francisco the next night, Denver the next night. I'm going, that's impossible.
Right.
But it happened. And that was in 1970 they were talking that. And so it was, I got into it when it was still, you know, for what it was. And then the change came and, you know, anyhow. I wasn't fitting.
Your career was during the time that it was from beginning to end of the, the hot era of the regional booking offices.
That's right. That's what I was trying to really say. That's right. It didn't last that much longer after I come off the road.
The thing is we growing up like we did, Jerry, as fans. We were in it when it was what we thought it was,
or what we hoped it was.
You can't knock success. I hope these guys are making a lot of money today, but you know, I wouldn't swap what we did for what they do now if I was able to do it.
I wouldn't either. I went down here last year when New York was here, and I sat there and Malenko put it. Me and a couple of my buddies on the front row, and I'm sitting there watching this, and I'm thinking, I hollered lots of stuff in Kearney. They didn't even turn around. They didn't know what I was talking about.
I've been there, done that. It wasn't
they
for a WWE show, but a little outlaw group in Florida, in Mobile, I was trying to tell the referee that there was a mark with a tin can at ringside, and I hollered at him, Ms. Ark, and he just looked at me like I was speaking Japanese or something.
They don't know. They don't know. But I was watching it, and it resembled something that I used to do.
Right.
And that's about all I can say. But the place was sold out. They sold more merchandise, man, than a Walmart.
Unbelievable.
I was at I was watching that kind of stuff, you know. I'm going, they had every kind of belt they had over there where you could have a picture made with it. Whatever belt you wanted, you know. What they charged for those pictures, I don't know, because I didn't get in line. I didn't care about having my picture made in one of those belts, of course. But they were selling, you can't imagine, y'all, you've probably been, they were selling all kind of merchandise, man. They were, people were running around with bags full of stuff and stuff over their belts, over their shoulders, and I'm going, my gosh.
My grandson is the biggest wrestling fan in the world. He'll be 13 this year, and all he knows is WWE. That's all he knows. Well, all he's ever seen. That's all there is. That's all he knows. He went to WrestleMania when it was here, what, 2 years ago? And I asked him, I said, when I buzzed Jerry Briscoe about, you know, a code to get tickets a little early where they could get their seats and stuff, and my son-in-law asked me, he says, well, you want us to get you a ticket? And I went, no, I'm busy. He said, well, what are you doing? I said, I don't know, but I'm busy. And I asked Blake. I said, Blake, I said, you all right? And he goes, yeah. He says, I got my ticket. He said, and I've got all my Christmas money and my money I've saved so I can buy my stuff. And I said, well, how much money are you taking? And he said, I don't know. I got about $175. And I said, you're kidding. He goes, no. And I said, well, you gonna spend, how much of it will you spend? He said, I may spend all of it. I mean, that's his thing, but, you know, I mean, I can't comprehend that. I wanted 15 cents for a program and a dime for a Coke, and I was tickled to death. If I got an extra 15 cents for a bag of popcorn, I was just in hog heaven.
But, guys, but, you know, I saw adults with the stuff. I saw adults.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's
crazy.
Oh, yeah, there's more 30-year-old marks right now than you've ever seen in this world. All you got to do is go to a wrestling chat room. You'll see that.
Listen, I've been with Charlie Smith when he sells his gimmicks. That's like Walmart, and he's got these pacifiers he sells, Jerry. And adults buy these things. It's a pacifier, but you hit the little button, man, and it's like a neon light. It's like a strobe neon light that flickers and everything. You'll go to the matches with Charlie, and he'll get through about before the main event starts. You can look out there, and there'll be them little pacifiers all over the arena. You know, they don't know who the wrestlers are, and they don't know what's going on, but they got them pacifiers going. It's crazy. And the other half that don't have pacifiers have masks on that he sold them.
Well, I tell you what, they probably got a truck trailer just haul their merchandise around.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
I'm sure they do.
Jeez.
I couldn't believe it. I was in awe.
Well, that's the name of the game now. It's, you know, what they sell out front, not what's going on in the ring.
I'm surprised they do as well as they do, because I think their director of sales is some punch drunk guy they got from Kansas City. Wichita.
Billy. But, you know, I just find it hard to believe that they're still doing as big a business as they did with, I mean, what I see on the internet, that'd be on Facebook or something, they really have no more names.
No.
You know?
They don't want any names. That's just it. You know, they'll have guys like Cena and stuff that are, you know, they'll build the company around, but that's why, you know, Vince gives them all gimmick names that he can trademark.
Right.
You know, they all look the same because he's selling the brand. He's not selling the individual wrestlers. He's selling the brand.
Because
you know, he doesn't want anybody to quit and, you know, go disappear like, I guess, CM Punk did on him.
No, and he'll agree to let them go through rehab, but he doesn't want them to use their name anywhere else.
Nope.
He'll pay for their rehab.
But, you know, the days of the Stone Cold are gone.
Oh, yeah.
Having somebody.
Well, see, I never was all that impressed with him.
I was. I really was. I watched him. Don't think he didn't work hard.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm sure he did. But I just, you know, that whole anti-hero thing, you know, it was such a, I don't know, I guess it was so different from, you know, the stuff that we did. And
I tell you what I would like to have is his T-shirt money.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I'm sure he sold more merchandise than Hogan.
Oh, I'm sure that's probably true, too. Hogan was selling popsicles. He wasn't selling T-shirts.
I remember
back about 1970, well, I guess it was about 1983, 84, right after I quit, Barnett had gone to New York working as a controller for McMahon, and he called me right after Christmas, and he just called to see how I was doing, wanted to know what I was doing, and, you know, blah, blah, just shooting a bull. You know, Barnett was nosy, and he just wanted to know, you know, he'd want to know, what's this one doing, what's that one doing? But he told me that day, he said, I'm about to do something that I've never done before as long as I've been in the wrestling business. And I said, well, what's that, Jim? He said, I'm fixing to write and hand a check to a wrestler for $1 million. And I said, for what? And he said, it's to Hulk Hogan. He said, that's what he made on the gimmicks this year.
Wow.
That wasn't his wrestling. That's what he made on the gimmicks.
Well, his wrestling was a gimmick.
That's the biggest gimmick that's ever out there. The biggest.
Bobby, is there somebody trying to call in on your phone?
Tell them you're busy.
Probably Smitty.
It is actually my daughter, and I'm fixing to jump off and call her on my cell. I'll be right back, guys.
All right.
Right after this. Well, while he's gone away, you want to do a commercial here, Mike?
Yeah, go ahead, Jay.
Okay. The Peach State Pandemonium podcast is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com. A leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. And if you sign up at our URL, which is audibletrial.com/GWHradio, you get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service. Back to you guys.
Thanks, sir.
Yes, sir.
Well, can you guys think of anybody else that had all the talent but just never got the push? It could have, in your opinion, could have gone a long way had they been used. You know,
well,
it's more in the other directions. How many of them got the push and had no talent?
Yeah, well, I know.
Well,
that's
let me
true.
Mention a guy that I thought started out very talented and was ruined by the guy we've been talking about, Vince, and that was Adrian Adonis. I can remember when he was Keith Frank.
Yep.
And starting out here, and you know, he was he seemed to be a guy that could do very well, and what he ended up being towards the end of his life was not only tragic for the people who enjoyed his work, but I'm sure it was for him too. And I mean, he did have a few brief moments there where he was looked like he was putting it all together again. But it was a very sad thing to see the way, you know, he ended up.
Well, it's a shame that, you know, so many of those guys, especially when the business was the territories were starting to die and Vince was buying up all the talent, he was buying talent that he didn't even use.
To keep somebody else from having.
Exactly. But the one that disappointed me the most, that was misused the most, in my opinion, was Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog. The Junkyard Dog was the second coming of Dusty Rhodes in Louisiana. He was in great shape. He wasn't a great worker by any chance, but he just had it, whatever it was, and he drew money, money in Louisiana. But, you know, then he goes from being, you know, this hard-nosed man of the people and you know, and having everybody on his side to going to New York, and he's dancing and singing and grabbing them cakes. I mean, I'm sure he made tons of money, but that was the worst thing that ever could have happened to him.
Well, he made tons of money for
his... drugs and you know, had too much time on his hands, or he was traveling too much or whatever, and got into the drug thing, and that's what, you know, that's not what killed him. He fell asleep driving a car, but I mean, he got out of shape, and it's just a shame, because he was, like I said, he was no great worker by anybody's stretch of the imagination, but he was what the business was all about. He drew fans, he put butts in seats, and he made nothing but money for Bill Watts.
Well,
I'll tell you how bad he was. I was there in 77. he comes into the territory. He was there 1 week, and Watts let him go. He was so fat and couldn't work, Watts just got rid of him. And the next time I saw him, he got smart. He got in a gym, and when he come back, nobody knew who he was. He looked unbelievable. You know who pushed him? You know who made him? Buck Robley.
Yep.
Buck Robley made him. And like you said, he drew nothing but money.
I jumped nothing in on the tail money. End. Who are we talking about?
JYD.
Oh, okay.
In fact, he went to Louisiana, he had been working for some outlaw groups in the Carolinas. I think he worked for George Becker when Becker was trying to run opposition in the mid-70s to Crockett's. And he came to Mobile in 77. He was there probably September or so, 77. He was only there about 2 or 3 weeks. Same way, and Lee pushed him, but he just didn't stay.
Well, you were talking about these guys that, as the territories were drying up, I'm sure when Vince put the money tree out there to them, I mean, they had no other choice. They knew that the jobs that they had were going away, and he offered them the big bucks. But in reality, he had the money to spend, but what he wanted to do was to take them up there and parade them out in front of the national audience and ruin them for anybody else to use them. I mean, you know.
Yeah. He made clowns out of them. Look what he did.
He did it with, he did it with Dick Slater. He did it with, with wrestling, too, by using him as a mid-card guy that got beat. And, if he didn't want them, and he didn't, he just wanted to make sure nobody else could use them. And that's what happened.
Very true.
Bo James sent me, he texted me here with a name that another guy that got a pretty good push on a very limited amount of talent, Rufus R. Jones.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about him, but on the other hand, he was a guy that was a hero to a lot of folks, you know, and he put some folks in the seats. And
yep.
I cringed every time I saw him do an interview. I thought as bad as his interviews were, his work at the ring was better than his interviews. And that wasn't anything to particularly talk about. But, I mean, in certain areas of the country, he was put over. And I think, I was looking back at some of the All-South programs today, Bobby, because I was looking for some of the guys we might have been talking about. And not putting it down, but, it was predominantly a minority audience. And it was a time when minorities were looking for heroes, and he was one of the guys that fit the bill.
Yep.
Well, another one that falls in that category, who's also named Jones, was Burrhead.
Yeah.
You can go to Montgomery right now and say, tell us, holler Burrhead Jones' name, and you'll draw a crowd.
Yes, sir.
And Burrhead couldn't work a lick. Couldn't talk a lick, stuttered. He stuttered almost as bad as Sweet Daddy Watts.
That's another name. Yeah. Burrhead was so over in Alabama. Now this is a funny story, but it's an absolute gospel truth. We're at the reunion down there 1 year, and it's the middle of the day, like on Thursday. The sun's shining; it's a pretty day. We all got our chairs out on the sidewalk. We got the whole hotel, and we're all outside sitting on the sidewalk in our chairs. I mean, me, myself, Charlie Smith, Dick Steinborn, Tom Ernesto Jr., Ted Allen, there was probably 10 or 12, Louis Talay, there was 10 or 12 of us standing there, sitting there talking. And Burrhead had the very last room on that side of the hotel. And these two guys came through and stopped and came up, and of course they're trying to sell us watches and necklaces and, different stuff. Well, finally when they realized we wasn't going to buy nothing, they got in their car and they started to drive off. When they got to the corner, they slammed on the brakes. I mean, their tires, they jump out, and when they jump out of the car, the first thing one of them hollers is, Burrhead Jones. Now, they ain't seen Burrhead in who knows how, but that's how over he is in Alabama, or was. Guess he still is.
Yeah, of course, he's probably got as many illegitimate children down there as Roberto Soto does in Georgia, too. But and another one, you know, on the opposite end of that, a guy who, you know, was just cannon fodder for even back before Vince Jr., but cannon fodder for the WWF that had a great build. Never heard him talk, so I don't know how he was there, but was a decent worker was SD Jones.
Yep. SD was here for a while. Good guy and could work.
Yeah, he's a very good worker.
Yeah.
But there again, you know, I don't know. New York had a thing of its own. They're champions, you know. Until they got Backlund, their champions really couldn't work. But chop meat like Bruno and Pedro. But they were over, and that was the main thing, you know.
Oh yeah,
they had the personalities. Even Bruno couldn't do a decent interview to save his life, but he had something built in. He just had, you could look at him and say, look and tell, he was like Fez. You could look at him and tell he was somebody because that's the way he carried himself.
Right.
And, you know, regardless of whether the fact he was a good worker or not, I'll always respect Bruno Sammartino for the way he felt about the business.
It still does.
Yeah, absolutely. But he looks better now at whatever age he is, early 80s or whatever age he is, than he did in the 60s. Because he's lost all that weight and everything. But
I was glad when he stopped wearing the mop on his head. I mean, you know, when he went through that phase where he was.
Well, it was worse when he did the Bob Armstrong afro. There's two members of on this panel here that had those for a while. Well, actually three, because I had one too, but I won't call the other one's names.
See, that was mine. Listen, I'll tell you something. You talk about the way he carried himself. We were, you know, in Las Vegas this year. Of course, the NWA is not what it used to be. We know that. But they had a on the card they had on Monday night at the hotel there. The main event was the NWA World Champion, the kid from Japan. I don't even know his name. He wrestled Rob Conway, I think's the guy's name. Great body, good looking guy. They had a decent match. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Thez and or it wasn't. Thez and Kaninsky or Bruno or Funk and Briscoe, but it was decent. And they swapped the title. Conway won the title. And the next day, and I'd never met the guy. I didn't know him. The next day, we're sitting downstairs in the gimmick room there, and he comes in. Now, here's a guy who won the world championship on Monday night. He walks in with a cut-off T-shirt, a pair of flip-flops, a pair of sweatpants or shorts. I can't remember what he had on. But I remember the first thing Bo said, there's your new champion.
There you go.
Now,
well,
had that been Thez won the title on Sunday night, if he had walked in that room, he'd have had on a shirt and tie, and you would have immediately known he was somebody, even if you didn't know who he was. And I just think we've lost that.
Absolutely.
You can't, like Jerry said earlier, you know, out wrestling in sneakers and cut-off jeans and a T-shirt. You can't tell the workers from the
no,
crowd.
No, you can't. It's
and you
I
go in the dressing room, you still can't tell because they got all their relatives in the dressing room. you want to set Bo James off, tell him, talk to him about that. Boy, he's the first one to clear out a dressing room. He doesn't do it the way Ron Bass used to, but, you know, so they'd be thankful of that. But Ron Bass could clear a dressing room quicker than anybody I ever saw. All he had to do was raise up one leg.
Well, I think we're losing our family show style here.
That's all right. But, there were so many guys that were on top because, of, you know, even though they didn't have a great deal of talent, but there was something unique about them. But, you know, Ox Baker, Tex McKenzie, guys like that. You know, I mentioned Stan Stasiak, and granted, I never saw Stan in his prime. I saw him, you know, from the 70s on. I know he did well here. There were guys that were big stars, and once you finally saw them, you know, they just weren't that impressive to me.
Well,
Masquerade, the biggest to me.
I think a lot of times it had to do with who they were working with, you know.
That's true. That's true. Because it does take two, or actually three of you. You got to have a decent referee too to make the whole thing work. But you know, about the time I came along is when looks took over the important part of the business over ability. You know,
well, that's why a lot of guys were on top for their size.
Yeah. Well, now, Billy Graham. You can blame three people for that, or not blame them, but the promoters who pushed them, and that's Hogan and the Road Warriors, you know, because they were built up as unbeatable because of their
physiques. Superstar Billy Graham. You ever see his matches?
Oh, yeah. He was not bad, too. But there again, it worked depending on who he was with. He and Dusty had great matches, but then I think Dusty could have had a great match with anything and anybody. You know, when Flair started out, he was good. He was good after he came back from the airplane crash. But when they started grooming him for the world title, especially if they put it on him, he became so repetitive.
Well, I don't know why they just didn't send film around him and don't even have him wrestle, because it was the same match.
Exactly.
Everybody raved about his, you know, God knows.
A lot of people got mad at Ole in his book because he said that, but that's fact. If you've seen one, you've seen all of them.
I've never seen anybody that repetitive, ever. He would do the same thing on TV as he would do on a house show.
Well, absolutely. And you would think, since, you know, back in our day we were selling it as a real sport, if a quarterback threw an interception every time, you know, when he was trying to hit one receiver and it was intercepted every time, you think he'd quit throwing to that receiver. You know, same thing with Flair getting slammed off the top rope. He did that three times in every match he ever had, you know, after he became champion. You'd think if it were a real sport and he was the world champion, he'd figure out not to do that.
Well, to me, and I would tell him to his face, to me, you turned the world title into a clown show.
Well, absolutely.
He did not carry himself as a world champion, in my opinion, or represent himself as a world champion wrestler in our business that I ever saw.
Nope.
That's my opinion.
The last good world champion we had was Harley. You know, Harley, you see Harley Race letting a referee like Tommy Young push you down?
Yeah.
And you backing off in the corner and waving, you know, begging off from a referee who weighed 138 pounds?
You take a shot in the corner, the turnbuckle, and stagger out three steps and fall on your shoulder, face down.
Exactly.
Every match? Come on. If that's
but
the world
fans
champion,
got used to it. That's what the fans wanted, so that's what he did. You know, because he would get the reaction.
Well, here's the thing. You don't let them control you. You
exactly.
Control them if you know what you're doing. I don't care what anybody says.
Two guys and a referee that know what they're doing, they're like an orchestra conductor.
Exactly.
They can bring that crowd out of their seat. They can put them on
their
butts.
You can
make
them stand up.
Whatever they want to do.
Sit down. You can make them throw the babies up in the air, the Cokes and popcorn and everything else.
Yes, sir.
That's my opinion. And that's about all I'm going to say about any of them. I'm getting hot.
You know, Jerry doesn't say a whole lot, but when he does, I should be writing down some of this stuff because it would really make a good book. And I'm not making fun of you, Jerry, because I can tell that, you know, it's you really got a lot you want to say, but you're trying to hold back.
Well,
but,
Jay, I just I'm not the only guy, but I'm like probably Mike and Bobby, I wanted to do that so bad.
Right.
And I wanted to be as good at what I did as I could be. And then I would see guys like a Flair go out there and clown. And
I know.
As great a worker as I, and I use that word, I don't use great workers that often. But I thought Dickie Murdoch was a great worker. But he would clown every night. He would have made a good world champion. They wasn't going to put that belt on him the way he clowned.
No.
I could not do that. I had too much pride in what it said on the marquee, professional wrestling, and I wanted to represent that is what I did. Whether that was right or wrong, I probably would have made more money going out there making a fool out of myself. That wasn't me. I couldn't do that, and that was just me. And you know, just some of the things, and this show is supposed to be about guys being pushed, and you take Lex Luger, great body. Watch one of his tapes.
Well, you know, and you know what, how he was built up, and at a certain point you start believing your press, and if you don't, then you do stuff to your body that you're trying to forget what you're doing. But I mean, think about how he turned out, and
Vince McMahon couldn't get him over.
Right. One thing I will say about McMahon, that I thought he was smart about up until the time of superstar Billy Graham, and that was that he only let his heels hold the world title for a short period of time. They were interim champions, and I never thought heels worked as well for the long-term championship bit as you were talking about Flair making every match look the same, you know, as the babyfaces did long-range, long-term, because You could put a baby face up against anybody, primarily against the heels, but he could work against anybody. But I just never saw a heel as being as successful as long term with the strap on them as a baby face was. And I think Flair made that, you know, they made that mistake with him in that he really shouldn't he shouldn't have held the NWA title as many times and as long as he did. He was a short-time champion.
They made a joke out of that, too.
Yeah.
Holding it so many times. You know, one of Fez's big things was he was seven-time world heavyweight champion.
Right.
You know, that was – it meant something. And then all of a sudden, you win it, you drop it, you win it, you drop it. It didn't mean anything.
Right.
It did not mean
anything. You can't even name the people he dropped it to.
No.
The only plus there I could see was that it increased the credibility of somebody thinking they could go to the match and see the title change. You know, maybe, but even that was short-term as far as being a sales point, I think.
You know how many times I saw that title change hands in my – when I say I saw it change hands in Vegas, but I don't count that. You know how many times I saw that title change hands?
How many?
In person, one time.
Me too.
And that was in Atlanta when Dusty won it, and I was sitting at ringside. I never was in the ring when it changed hands. Now, I refereed a bunch of world title matches, but I never was in the ring when it changed hands. I just, you know,
I saw Rich.
I know you were there tonight. Rich won it. Yeah.
You
didn't believe that one either, did you?
I thought they were going to take me to the emergency room.
That's another good one. All right. That's all right.
But you know, it meant something back then. They swapped it so much it didn't mean anything.
And now, I mean, they're even worse now. And there again, you go on these message boards and everything. The modern wrestling fans, you know, this I guess the big babyface in besides Cena in New York is this guy named Roman Reigns, which I think is one of the Anawaiis. He's related to Alpha Seeker or one of them, but. You know, he's been wrestling a year, and they're ready for him to have the world title. And they've gotten to where now everybody, if you stay there 6 or 8 months, you get at least one
right.
run with a world title up there.
Yeah,
and everybody has gotten so accustomed to this that they go back and look at the NWA and they say, well, you know, most people associate the NWA as only being Jim Crockett Promotions in the 80s. Because that's all they know. That's when they were growing up, and that's what they saw on TV. You know, they don't know who Lou Thesz is. Dory Funk Jr. was boring. So why was he world champion? He was boring. Sergeant Slaughter ought to have been NWA world champion.
Hey, there's another good name right there.
Slaughter?
Yeah.
In which category? Got a push? Yeah. Didn't have the talent?
Yeah.
He wasn't that bad.
He well, you got. I guess you've got to break it down as between that bad and you
he
know. Yeah, I agree
bad.
With you. I saw him several different personas, but for as you said, put the title on him. I'm sure a lot of people would have thought that would have been just fine.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, everybody thinks, why didn't he have a run? He should have at least gotten a 2-month run. Well, see, that's what ruined it. You know, and going back, and I don't know, you guys, and I'm not old enough to have seen this guy in his prime, but I've seen videotape of him. For him to be, you know, considered such a big star in Canada, and he was behind Yvonne Robert, probably the biggest star Canada ever had, was Whipper Watson. I didn't see a thing impressive about him in the videotapes I've seen of him. He was horrible.
I was in the ring with Whipper Watson Jr. Does that count?
Well, he was much better from what I've seen.
There's another guy that was only weighed $160, $170.
Yeah.
Right.
And you talk about a circus. When he came in to work for Ann, it was him and a girl named Rachel Dubois.
Yeah.
And two midgets.
I can say he probably
all traveling
had midgets
with him. Yeah, all traveling in one car. But that, you know, I mean, this. You could go on and on and on naming guys that, you know, it all boiled down to being in the right place at the right time.
Oh, sure.
Booker liking you, Booker not liking you, promoter liking
Tommy
you, not
Rich.
Liking you.
Tommy
you
Rich.
Seeing something.
Tommy,
yeah.
Tommy so. Rich was at the right place at the right time. Most
yes,
unathletic
sir.
Guy, one of the most unathletic guys I've ever seen in the business. I don't care what you say about if you ever worked with, if you didn't work with these guys, you can't really comment on these guys.
Yeah.
I've worked with him.
I never wanted to because
he
was always so skied up. I was afraid he'd hurt me.
He couldn't even take an arm drag. And here's a guy that got pushed as hard as any. You take anybody that's a smart booker, they can get anybody over. If he happened to be in the clique, and that's the way it worked. I saw when they had that last fan fest in Charlotte, on the internet, a picture of the former world heavyweight champion, Tommy Rich, the way he was dressed, I almost cried. He had about four damn teeth, got a bandana on, and one of those, a 1972 tie-dye t-shirt. I'm thinking, this is a guy they put the world title on, even though it's 5 days. He was up there at this place representing our business as a former world champion, dressed like, I don't know what he was dressed like. I sat there and almost cried. Had no respect for what he did, who he was supposed to be, nothing. And they invested money pushing him. I got a standard poodle. It's got more class than that. And she's so smart, you could take her and push her and put her on top.
Well, going back kind of what we were talking about, small guys that you know, weren't believable. Two guys that weren't the biggest in the world, especially one of them, but just were world beaters and were believable to me, was Robert Gibson and Ricky Morton. And Ricky especially, because he was such a, you know, underdog babyface that, you know, it would just take a beating and never give up and all that stuff. People just got behind him like crazy. And that kind of leads me to one that could have gone much further than he did. And he had success in several different territories, but nowhere near what his talent would, you know, should have allowed him to do. And again, he might have had personal demons that got in the way, was Ricky Gibson. What a worker he was.
I always thought the exact same thing. First time I saw him in Atlanta. You know, he was pushed as Tim Woods' protege. And I thought he was very, you know, excellent for his age and what they were doing with him at the time. And he didn't stay here a whole long time, but I thought he could have been, once again, he was one of the guys that I thought could have been bigger than he was.
You could put him and Billy Spears in any arena in the Gulf Coast territory, and it settled out just about.
I don't doubt it.
They had some tremendous, and I mean, lasted for years. You know, they could cool it off, and one of them be gone from the territory a year or two, and come back, and they hook right back up, and they'd start drawing again.
Well,
same
fans
way with Soto and Spears here.
Well, see, fans would remember how good those matches were. You know,
right.
I mean, certain things stay with you, And it's like seeing a band, you know, that you really like, and a couple of years later they're back, and you know, somebody will say, well, hey, you've seen everything they've done. Well, what the heck? I want to see them do it again, you know. And I think that's the way it was with those kind of guys. It didn't matter. They performed the first time, and you expected to do the same thing the second time, and in most cases they did.
Jerry, did you ever work with Ricky, team with him in wrestling?
Team a couple of times. Never worked with him.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was a good worker. I really did.
Bobby, I know you were in the ring with him a lot.
Yeah, I was in the ring with him a lot.
But I think Ricky got to fooling with stuff he shouldn't have. And
he did.
Exactly, yeah.
He did. And died much too young, but that's, yeah, you know.
I never understood all that either. But.
Well, you mentioned Billy Spears. There's another guy. Billy wasn't a big guy either.
No.
He could get some heat,
though. 5'5", 5'6"?
He could get some heat.
Yes,
oh,
he
God,
could.
Yes.
Could he?
He worked hard.
Billy just had that look about him. You know, he's like Jack Donovan. He could walk into a room and you'd hate him the minute he stepped into the room, but just because of the look on his face. Jack Donovan told me one time, he said where he learned that from. When he was very young in the business, he went out to the Pacific Northwest, and they had him traveling for a couple of months with Gorgeous George. You know, George always, and once he got to be a big star, he always had another wrestler kind of be his handler because he drank so bad. And, you know, he had guys like, what was the guy's name? He was a promoter out in California, but he also wrestled. His name will come to me once we're done with the show. No. This guy was an old-timer. I can't think of his name now. It wasn't Hardy Kruskamp. Hardy Kruskamp did the same thing for Primo Carnera. It's like back in the day when usually when guys like that got into the business, whoever broke them in the business traveled with them. Like Haystack Calhoun, if you look at any of his early results for his matches, always on the card with him, and usually his opponent was Judo Jack Terry. That's because that's who trained him. When Giant Baba came to the U.S., he always was working with Fred Atkins because that's who trained him. And I can't think of this guy's name. But anyway, Jack got assigned to him out there in Seattle, traveling with him, and he noticed how George was could make the people hate him. And he asked him, how do you do that when you really, you know, you hadn't even gotten in the ring yet and everybody's wanting to kill you? He said, always have the look on your face like you just stepped in something and the smell just hit you. And he said, Jack had it to a T. If you've ever seen pictures of him and everything, promo pictures of him, he's got his nose up in the air like he smells something horrible. And that's the way he treated the fans, and that's what drew him heat. And Spears was the same way. You know, he could walk into a room and people would instantly hate him. Jerry Graham had that talent.
Well, guys, I'm going to have to go. But before I go, I want to congratulate Bobby Simmons on the Falcons winning last Sunday.
Yeah, they had to do it at the expense of my Saints, but it was a whale of a game. If we had to lose, there was no shame in losing to the way Matt Ryan played.
There was just never a doubt in my mind what was going to happen.
Yeah, he heard it 2 weeks ago. Boy, they better not play like that when the Saints come here. Them boys mean business.
I'm not real sure. Hey, who knows?
That's all because Bobby was in the stands coaching them.
That's it. Yeah, I was phoning down, telling them what to do.
Well, guys, I'm gonna have to get out of here, guys.
All right, Jerry. Well, we'll go ahead and wrap this up. I think we beat everybody we can beat anyway. And Charlie only got one plug tonight.
Oh, my
goodness.
He's not
even listening, so, you know.
But not now, he's not.
Charlie will be at the Gwinnett County Fair for the next 2 weeks. He'll have a table there. Y'all go by and see him.
Except on the, is it the 21st?
Except on the, the 20th. His grandson's getting married. He won't be there that day, so.
Yeah, he is, too. He's going. He told me, I talked to him yesterday. He said as soon as the ceremony's over, He's heading out and going back to Gwinnett County Fair because he's got Gene covering for him.
Yeah, he wants to go back and get the first count.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right, good night, everybody. And we'll do this again next week and see what we can talk about.
All right, good night, guys.
Thanks.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.